Thank you very much for this kind introduction, and also thank you very much for giving me the opportunity here in your institute to present our views on the global economic outlook. So my plan is to talk for 30-40 minutes, and we can then have a question-answer session, or, you know, I'm also very keen on hearing your comments. So for me, the reason why I'm traveling and presenting this is to get feedback on our views, to hear criticism, or to get inspiration, you know, for new topics that we then work on in subsequent world economic outlook. So by all means, please, I encourage you to give me feedback, positive, negative. Any feedback is better than no feedback. And I'm also glad to answer all questions. I'm also happy to take questions while I'm presenting. So whichever way you want to do this, if you have a question, don't hesitate to interrupt. So, in typical American fashion, I'll give you the conclusions first of what I'm going to talk about, and then I'm going to try and convince you that these are indeed the right conclusions. First, what we're seeing is a global economic recovery that is solidifying, pretty strong in emerging economies, there we're already in expansion phase, but also gaining ground in advanced economies. However, in the advanced economies, the growth rate is still fairly low considering the depth of the fall of activity that these economies experience, and it'll take a long time before high unemployment rates will be brought down. Now, with us have been certain policy challenges already for a year or two, which to a large extent remain unaddressed. There is a need for significant fiscal adjustment that has to set in many advanced economies following the large fiscal stimulus that was deployed in order to forestall that the Great Recession turns into a Great Depression. So a lot of fiscal adjustment is needed. And there's also still a significant amount of financial repair that has to take place in advanced economies. These challenges are remaining with us. Another challenge that's remaining with us already and has been with us for a year or two, has even been there before the crisis, is what we call global demand rebalancing. And I'll talk about that in more depth afterwards. There is a need for some parts of the world to move increasingly, gradually, but increasingly towards more domestic sources of growth. And this is a process that will take some time, that is complex, but it's a process that is important for these countries to embark on, we believe. And in the meantime, we also have some more recent challenges that are facing the global economy. There are signs of overheating in some emerging economies that are becoming apparent. There is a challenge posed by capital inflows, and then there is a challenge posed by high commodity prices. So let me walk you through these different parts of the world economic outlook. So I'll start with recent developments and what we call the world economic outlook, the real forecast. So let's first take stock. Here you're seeing two charts. On the left-hand side, you're seeing equity markets. In red, you see the DJ Euro stocks. In brown, you see the S&P 500. And then in green and in blue, you see, respectively, stock market indices for Asia and Latin America. And just look at the end of that chart. What you see is that in Asia and Latin America, stock markets are already back to pre-crisis levels, so there's a lot of recovery that's taking place in financial markets. But look at the U.S. The S&P 500 is also within, you know, 10% off the pre-crisis peak. So bottom line is, a lot of normalization has already taken place in financial markets. On the right-hand side, you see a chart that measures risk in financial markets. And one measure of risk is the so-called VIX on the S&P 500. And you can see how this spiked during 2009. You see this big, big move upwards. But how it has now come back down to levels that are not very different from those that prevailed during 2004, 5, 6, and 7. So a significant amount of normalization has taken place in financial markets. But there are certain parts of financial markets that remain still in a very abnormal state. And here what I'm showing you are charts of credit, bank credit growth rates. On the left-hand side, you see the credit growth rates of the United States, the euro area, and Japan. And as you can see at the end of the sample, you see this little oval. It's all around zero. So banking sectors are still struggling to return to normal and will be struggling to return to normal for some time in the advanced economies. On the right-hand side, I'm showing you credit growth rate in emerging economies. Hong Kong, Brazil, China, India, and Turkey. Again, look at the end of the sample. You see an oval there. And these growth rates, in real terms, are all between 15 and 30%. So these are very large growth rates. So we have one extreme in Europe and almost another extreme in the emerging economies. And that is something I'll get back to later that is worth watching out for. Finally, let's look at capital flows to emerging economies. On the left-hand side, I'm giving you one measure of capital flows, which is emerging market issuance of debt and equity and syndicated loans. And what you can see is in 2009 Q1, that bar has become pretty small. So that's when we had basically the peak of the crisis, the sudden stop. And since then, the flows have recovered. But it's important to note that the flows now are not in kind of a record territory. They are high, but not in record territory. Moreover, look to the chart on the right-hand side now, which is a high-frequency chart. It gives you more of an appreciation of what's been going on over the last year. It starts in January 2010 and goes through March 2011. And there, I'm just pointing out that lately, capital flows have been volatile. You can see that after QE2 and the Asia crisis, actually, there's been some drop in capital flows to emerging economies, and then since then there's been recovery and the drop again. So the message is, capital flows were strong before the crisis, they dried up during the crisis and recovered remarkably quickly, but they do remain volatile. And you can see this at the tail end of the sample right now. So within this world, where we're seeing substantial normalization in financial markets, still concerns in credit markets and banks, and a gradual normalization of capital flows, what do we see in terms of real growth rates? We see what we call a multi-speed recovery, with strong growth rates in the emerging economies of around 6.5%. And you can see this on the right-hand side of the figure, where you see growth rates for emerging Asia in red, above 8%. In blue, growth rates for Latin America of around 4.7%, 4.5% for 2011. And then in brown, you see the Middle East, which is a region in turmoil, but still the growth rates there are not too bad, around 4%. On average, given the heavy weight of Asia, this adds up to 6.5%. On the left-hand side, you see the growth rates for the advanced economies. And what you can see is that the growth rates there typically for 2011 are in a range of, the Japan growth forecast, I should say, is already outdated. But for the euro area, and actually the euro area forecast has also become outdated because the euro area has done so well in the first quarter. But the bottom line is you see growth rates that on average are only 2.5%. So much lower than in the emerging economies. That is to be expected. But they are also low if you consider how deeply activity has fallen during the crisis. There's an old rule over many years that held in the U.S. economy, which said that the deeper the economy fell, the more it would rise again. This time, this rule, which is called the Zanowitz rule, doesn't hold. And the reason is that financial sectors are still significantly impaired, and that the imbalances that had built up before in the housing sector were very, very large. And so that's why we get only a relatively modest recovery after this crisis, which will come with high unemployment for a long time. So, around this outlook, we are typically also trying to gauge risk. We give you a number for global growth of 4.5%, 6.5% growth in the emerging economies, 2.5% in the advanced economies, and then we try to get an idea of, well, what could make things better than we expected, or what could make them worse? And that's what we call the risk analysis. And the risk analysis we summarize in a fan chart. A fan chart shows you in red where our central forecast is, and that forecast is for 2011 and 12, right around 4.5%. Then in blue, in dark blue and in clear blue, you see confidence intervals. And the clear blue confidence interval is the 90% confidence interval. And it shows that, you know, the 90% confidence will have growth between 2 and 6%. It also shows you that this 90% confidence interval is smaller than the confidence interval that is depicted by the dotted orange lines. The dotted orange lines depict the 90% confidence interval of 1 year ago when we made a forecast for 2 years ahead, right? So the chart shows you the risks have diminished over time. which is consistent with what you see in financial markets. Now, there are some risks that could entail stronger growth than we forecast, and I've noticed those in the red little quadrant on top. Namely, activity in many emerging economies is quite buoyant, policy conditions are still fairly accommodative, and thus growth in the emerging economies could be stronger than what we forecast. Also, in many advanced economies, you have fairly strong balance sheets in the non-financial corporate sector. Companies, especially those quoted on stock exchanges, are doing fairly well. And it may well be that investment as a result turns out stronger than what we forecast. So this could mean that growth is stronger than what we forecast. But there are also important concerns that could, if they materialize, lead to lower growth than what we expect. First and foremost among these is everything surrounding the nexus between high government debt in the advanced economies and financial sector weaknesses. And that's particularly pronounced in the periphery of Europe. And if risks there materialize, they could spill over and destabilize global financial sectors and therefore lead to lower growth than what we expect. And the second downside risk that we are quite concerned about is related to oil supply concerns, high oil prices. And high oil prices cut into households' disposable incomes, and in so doing could also undermine the recovery of demand. So let me focus here very briefly on two special risks. One which I haven't mentioned is that related to Japan, because it's increasingly becoming less of a risk and more of a baseline because we understand better what's happening. And the second is I'd like to go a little more into depth as to the risk presented by oil prices. So what do we typically see after earthquakes? We see a large disruption of activity in response to earthquakes. You can see this here on the left-hand side. In blue you see the real GDP growth rate for Japan before Kobe and after Kobe. So just before Kobe you see the blue line dipping to zero, but then it's followed by just after Kobe you have the line dipping to zero, and then the recovery starts at the point where you see the dotted horizontal line. So the story of earthquakes has been large disruption to activity in the short run, followed by significant rebuilding afterwards, and usually no permanent effects. And that is pretty much what we are also expecting for this time in Japan. Sorry, this chart here on the left doesn't show very well, so it was supposed to show the range of forecasts. You can see it a little bit here. This is our forecast for growth in Japan. In the world economic outlook, it was prepared at a time when the situation was still very unclear in Japan, and we hadn't factored in the extent of the disruption. And this is the forecast of consensus. If you poll a large number of economists, their forecast is between for 2011 zero growth and 1% growth. And over the last couple of months, this has gradually shifted down. And so I'm expecting we will be coming out with a new forecast soon, and that forecast will look different from what we have right now. One important question is, how could this earthquake affect the rest of the world? And that's maybe something that's particularly relevant also for Malaysia. There are basically three ways for it to spill over to the rest of the world. The first is trade. Right, trade with Japan will be affected. In the short term, there will be less trade with Japan. It will, of course, be made up in 2012, but in the short run, there is a loss. Now, that, however, is unlikely to be a very large effect for Asia, because total exports of Asia to Japan are only equivalent to 4 to 5% of total Asian exports. So Japan is important, but not that important. The second source of spillovers is through the supply chain. So there, you've heard it, specific parts, for example, that are widely used in automobile production are produced to a large extent in certain companies in Japan, and this has disrupted the supply chain. Now, are these effects going to be large? Our view is, this is very hard to assess because we don't have a clear understanding of all the supply lines. But if you look at the stock prices of downstream producers, these stock prices have actually not declined that much. And so there is confidence that these effects are not that big. And there's another reason to be not too worried, is that when the earthquake struck, they had the large inventories accumulated by many downstream producers, and they have used those as a buffer. So we believe that there will be spillovers, but they will be limited. They won't be very large. And finally, the third way of spillovers is through the effect of the earthquake on capital flows. And one concern people have is that there will be a lot of repatriation by Japanese insurance companies. But so far, we actually haven't seen large effects. And even when you look at the Kobe earthquakes, the effects weren't big. So overall, we don't expect a big effect from the Japan earthquake on the rest of Asia. And in any case, to the extent an effect materializes, there's going to be a big makeup happening in 2012. Now, oil is a different story. Oil is becoming increasingly a concern. I'm showing you here on the left-hand side a price for oil in real terms, which is indexed to 100 in 1995. And what you can see is that this, since 1995, prices for oil in real terms in the red line basically quadrupled, right? You went from 100 to 400. During the crisis, you saw a large decline, a significant decline of oil prices. You can see it. But in the meantime, we've actually recovered. We are back. We are above pre-crisis levels. I'd also like to draw your attention to food prices. I'll talk about those a little later in more depth. But what's been driving oil prices are really three factors. The first is a fundamental strengthening of demand for oil on account of the high growth rates of emerging economies. The second has been the recovery from the crisis, right? And the third has been what we call a special factor, the unrest in Libya, right? Now, in all of this, Libya is an important consideration, but it's actually a far smaller consideration than the structural strengthening of emerging market demand and the recovery from the cyclical low during the recession. It's a much smaller effect. And I'm trying to illustrate this with the chart on the right-hand side. If you look at the lowest red line in the chart on the right-hand side, it shows you what OPEC's spare capacity is. And that red line is right around 4.5 million barrels per day in January 2011. You can see it there. Now, if you add to OPEC's spare capacity government stocks, you get to 7 million barrels per day. And then if you add on top of that industry stocks, you get to 10 million barrels per day. And I'm showing you in green the share of Libya in total oil production, about 1.5 million barrels per day. So Libya can easily be absorbed, right? Libya is not something that is going to derail the recovery on account of breaking the back of the global oil market. So here's a sequence of oil price events. In April 2010, we expected that oil prices in 2011 would be $83 per barrel. You see that on the left-hand side. By January 2011, we had upped our estimate to $90 per barrel, mainly on account of stronger world demand than what we expected. And then when we came out with the WEO in April, we had as an assumption for our forecast that oil prices would be $108 per barrel. Now, by the time the WEO hit the press, that's when oil prices really went haywire and briefly reached $120 per barrel. But since then, they have come back down to $106 per barrel, which is where they are right now. So basically, I would argue that what happened in global oil markets over the past few months is still consistent with our forecast. It hasn't made our forecast obsolete. Now, I want to go a little more in depth into the risks that oil prices present. So, one question we ask ourselves is, well, what are the reasonable risk scenario? And we thought, like, okay, a reasonable risk scenario might be that oil prices touch $150 per barrel, but then come back down. If they touch $150 per barrel because of increasing unrest in the Middle East, that takes time, that introduces an uncertainty premium, it drives up oil prices, but then as the uncertainty is resolved, you know, the oil price comes back down. So we ask ourselves the question, well, how likely would such a scenario be? If we're looking at option prices in oil markets, what's the likelihood that these option prices, that prices over the coming year might be higher than $150 per barrel? And you can see this at three points in time. We've computed that probability in January, in March, and then in May. Let's focus on March, and let's focus on what I call the nine-month forward, which is, you know, basically asking ourselves the question, over the coming 9 months, what's the probability but oil prices will be above 150, you see a number which is 9.4, it tells you it's 9.4%. So back in March, the probability of going above 150 was pretty appreciable, was quite sizable, almost 10%. Now it is back down to 3%. So oil markets have become considerably less tense, less of a risk for the global recovery. We then ask ourselves, well, okay, what would happen to the global economy if oil prices really did reach $150 per barrel for 1 year and then came back down to the baseline of 108? And so we ask our desk, well, what would be the effect on output in your economies over the years 2011 and 2012? I mean, it takes a little bit of time for an oil price shock to affect the economy, so you need to look at 2 years. And what you see for the advanced economies, you see that they would lose activity over 2 years, that is equivalent to almost 0.8% of their GDP. Now, that is a sizable amount. Why? Because if over these 2 years you grow only by 2.5% each year, then in 2 years you grow by around 5%, and you're losing 0.8% of that. That is a pretty big effect. I mean, it's not a disaster, but it's a big effect. For developing Asia, the figure is similar. It's 0.7% of GDP. But since developing Asia grows by 8% every year, 16% over 2 years, losing 0.8% of that is not such a big deal. Right. So, for the global economy, the scenario is of a concern for the advanced economies. It's of a lesser concern for the emerging economies. What is a much bigger concern is what will happen to oil over the medium term. And there are good reasons to believe that over the medium term, oil markets will remain quite tense, and that the risks are for further significant increases in oil prices. Here is an analysis. Let's focus for the moment on what I call in this table supply, right? Supply here, that's the annual growth rate of oil supply every year as estimated by the International Energy Agency. It's 1.5% per year between 2011 and 2015. That's what they're estimating. For comparison, during the 1980s and the 1990s, average growth was 1.8% per year. So we are over the future, we're going to have less oil growth, oil supply growth, than we had in the past. But we also know that over the future, actually, we're going to have higher world growth than what we have had in the past. Right? That's especially during the 80s and 90s. So we've asked ourselves, what could happen to oil markets, to oil demand? Now, if you take the estimates of the International Energy Agency, you look to demand and you see the world, you see 1.3%. That's their estimate for global growth of demand for oil. It's actually lower than for supply, so their message is a reassuring one. When we take our estimates of the elasticity, they use our growth rates, but they just use a low elasticity of oil demand for growth. If we use our own elasticities of oil demand for growth, you can see in the memorandum items below that depending on what kind of elasticity you use, you can have between 1.3 and 3% growth each year in demand for oil, right? So if you were to have 3% demand each year for demand growth for oil each year, and you have only 1.5% supply growth, the answer is, well, there's going to have to be a very large increase in prices to bring the two in line. Right. And supply cannot move much in the short run. It will be demand that will have to be brought into line with supply, and it will be through a large price increase. So the bottom line is here, we are quite concerned about the tensions in global oil markets. They're very important, and they will also have ramifications for food prices in the end. Indeed, one of the major inputs into food is fertilizer, which in turn, the price is largely determined by oil. So that's why I just want to go briefly over how we see food markets. Now, what we see in food markets, you see it in the blue line here, is there's been a large increase in food prices. And that increase in food prices is considerably driven by, again, a structural factor, strong demand in emerging economies. Now, it is not really strong demand for food per se. It is strong demand that boosts oil prices, that boosts fertilizers, and that in turn boosts the cost of input into food. But that said, recently, you can see that at the tail end of the sample, the last 2 years, there have also been special factors at work, namely bad harvests in Europe and in the southern hemisphere on account of La Niña. Now, we expect those special factors to go out of the picture. That should permit some decline in food prices over the next few years. But the situation that's shown in red with respect to food stocks will be very tense because food stocks are still low and it'll take some time before these are rebuilt. So, again, the situation with respect to food prices is not as worrying over the medium term as for oil prices, because there's a lot of room still to increase productivity in food production, right? But it is still a concern in the short run because of low inventories. Policy challenges. Now, policy challenges are always a function of the different cyclical positions of the various economies, and I'm showing you these here on the left-hand side. I'm showing you where is real GDP in these economies standing relative to a pre-crisis trend. And in blue, you see that the emerging economies are above 100, meaning they're already operating above pre-crisis trends. They're doing quite well. The emerging economies, however, are still falling short of pre-crisis trends. And you can see in blue, on the right-hand side, a line for core inflation in emerging economies, and you can see how at the end of the cycle, this is moving up. It's consistent with resource utilization that is already moving above capacity. While in advanced economies in red, core inflation is still very low at between 1 and 2%. So, that means that in the advanced economies, because of low inflation, we believe policy rates, real policy rates, monetary policy rates, can stay very accommodative and low. The challenge in the advanced economies is really fiscal adjustment. And that's shown here on the right-hand side of this panel. In blue, you see, let's focus on the red line, which shows you public debt. And on the axis on the left, you can see that the red line moves up, up, and up. And now look over to the left, and you see that it exceeds 100% of GDP. So in advanced economies, by the year 2016, on present plans, we're going to be having gross government debt exceeding 100% of GDP. That's a large amount of debt. And it raises policy concerns. And that is, for these economies, the main challenge. It's to rein in this increase in debt and ultimately bring it down again. Let's focus here on the right-hand side of the chart. The right-hand side of the chart shows you, by the height of the bar, the amount of fiscal adjustment that needs to be effected by the various advanced economies in order to stabilize the debt by 2015 and then reduce it gradually to 60% of GDP by 2030. So let's focus on Japan on the way left. It requires adjustment of almost 14% of GDP. It's a massive amount of fiscal adjustment that has to take place. For the U.S., the figure is above 10%. And the red dot shows you how much has already been programmed and how much remains to be done. So the U.S. has not even done half of this adjustment yet. There is much more to come. It's a big challenge. And then you can see the challenges for the other economies, which are less, because much of it is already projected to happen, but they're still major, and they will have repercussions for medium-term growth. What about the emerging economies? Now, in the emerging economies, here on the left-hand side, I'm showing you where real interest rates are right now. And you can see two circles. And the circle that is the most recent one is below the circle that is before. And that means that rates right now are lower than they were before the crisis. But activities are already above pre-crisis trends. And so there is here a case for monetary policy rates that have to rise, consistent with higher inflation. On the right-hand side, you see an estimate of fiscal balance. The first message I want you to get away from it, take away from this, is the red line, which shows you public debt. Public debt in the emerging economies is, as a percent of GDP, on a declining trend. So fiscal, in the grand scheme of things, is not a big challenge. Nonetheless, if you look at the blue line, you can see that fiscal balances now are lower than they were before the crisis. They're in deficit and they were in surplus before the crisis. And we think that it's now again time to gradually, in various economies, reduce the fiscal deficit so as to rebuild room for policy maneuver in future crises. But, you know, it is a bigger challenge for some economies than for other economies. And it's, in the grand scheme of things, not a major challenge because public debt is on a downward trend. A big challenge in the various emerging economies is credit growth. What I'm showing you here, and let's just focus on the blue bars, is credit growth in per capita terms and in real terms over the last 5 years. If it is over 100, it means that credit has doubled over the last 5 years in real terms and in per capita terms. And it is over 100 for CN on the left, which is China, the BR, which is Brazil, and it's at 100% for Turkey, TR. And it's at a health, it is a strong, you know, 70% in Peru, Colombia, India, and Indonesia. Indonesia is the last one, which is ID. So there has been a lot of credit growth. No, Malaysia is not a concern of ours. In Malaysia, the growth rates were just not as high, so didn't make it into the chart, I'm afraid. Okay. Fortunately for you. I don't know. So the issue here is really, the issue for these economies is, you know, they need to watch out that there is another new boom-bust cycle in the making. And this will require not only macroeconomic adjustment in terms of raising interest rates, it will also require macroprudential tools, looking at those. Now, let me lastly talk about the one thing that brings advanced and emerging economies really together, and that's what we call global demand rebalancing. Before the crisis, emerging economies were, as a whole, were running current account surpluses, and advanced economies were running current account deficits. And there were large divergences between the two. And you can see this in the left-hand side chart. The bars are very wide. There's a lot above zero and a lot below zero in 2008. And you can see the various regions. In yellow, for example, you have the contribution of China and emerging Asia. And in red, you have the contribution of oil exporters. Now, what you see is that these imbalances have come down, right? So many people say that that's good news. Global imbalances have decreased. Well, the bad news is that it happened at the price of a large global recession. The reason global imbalances narrowed is that consumption in the U.S. and in various advanced economies has collapsed, right? And what you're seeing on the right-hand side is, I'm showing you here, estimates of total domestic demand for economies with external surpluses, for example, right? Blue and red. What you can see is that for these economies that had external surpluses, demand hasn't accelerated relative to before the crisis. The red bars are below the blue bars. So you've had a collapse in demand in deficit economies such as the U.S. and others that hasn't been made up for by an expansion in stronger demand growth elsewhere. And there's good reasons why this cannot happen overnight, because it's difficult to stimulate demand or to build demand on a sustainable basis. But the bottom line is, we have had some rebalancing through negative factors, and we still have large global imbalances that remain with us, and you can see this here on the right. And probably, if oil prices rise, they will increase again over the medium term to more than what we are forecasting here. So, what is the challenge then with respect to global imbalances? The task here is, for basically in broad terms, for demand in economies with large external surpluses to accelerate, and for their exchange rates to appreciate. Now, the two will require macroeconomic changes, that's where the exchange rate policy falls under, and other policies, but also structural changes. And the structural changes will take time. The problem we have is that presently, a lot of the appreciation of the exchange rate appreciation part is happening only to selected economies. And you can see this on the right-hand side. It shows you the real exchange rate changes between before the crisis and now. And the exchange rates that have appreciated are typically those of the excessive external deficit economies among the emerging economies. And these are the ones in Latin America. So a lot of the rebalancing on the exchange rate front has fallen on Latin America. Less has fallen on Asia. And that's why you hear a lot of complaints in Latin America. You hear the talks about currency wars, right? And for them, this presents a challenge. So let me wind up with a few remarks on dealing with capital inflows, which is what these Latin American countries are struggling with right now, but also a number of Asian economies are struggling with. So again, here I'm just showing you that over the long term, you know, you've had healthy capital flows in to emerging economies. They collapsed during the crisis, and they have recovered since. You can see this on the right-hand side, the black line. Collapsed during the crisis, recovery since then. Now, if you look at the rightmost bars of each of these little charts, you can see that they are not much higher than the bars that were there before. And that just basically shows you that capital flows right now aren't much bigger than they used to be. So it's not really a reason to be alarmed at global or regional levels. But there are specific countries that are receiving a very large share of these flows. Right? So you really have to go down to the country level to detect the tensions. And Brazil is one of these countries, but Turkey, South Africa, there are a bunch of others that count among them. So what's the concern with capital flows? Well, it's that they are very volatile. I already showed you that before, and this gives you an econometric appreciation of this. A simple AR1 coefficient, you regress capital flows today on in the past, and then what you see is you get coefficients of 0.2 or 0.3, that's the black line. It means capital flows can come, and they can go very rapidly again. So that's the concern with capital flows. And I'm going to skip through this here. And what is then, therefore, the concern? The concern is that as the U.S. economy begins to normalize and U.S. interest rates rise, that maybe then the flows that have come into the emerging economies will rapidly again flow out. Now, I want to put these concerns into perspective because low interest rates in the U.S. are only one factor that is driving capital flows to emerging economies. There are two other factors that are structural factors and that will remain with us. The first is that there is, in general, high savings in Asia. And these high savings are looking for an outlet in global financial markets. And a large part of these high savings are basically reserves in China that are being invested in treasury bills. These investments in treasury bills lower the rate of return, the long-term rate on 10-year treasury bills, to a level such that investors start thinking it's not anymore very attractive, and they go and search for yields. And when they go and search for yields, they end up in emerging economies and elsewhere. So you have that structural factor there of high savings in China that is also related to yield searching and then flows to other emerging economies. The second structural factor is high oil prices. High oil prices mean that a lot of funds are flowing suddenly to very few people, the oil producers. And obviously, for them it doesn't make sense to spend all that money. They will have to save it because oil is an exhaustible resource. And they save it by, again, investing in treasury bills and so forth, lowering yields, and therefore prompting investors to search for yields elsewhere in emerging economies. So you have three factors that are driving global capital flows. And only one of them will maybe disappear very gradually over the next 2 to 3 years. For the others, it's not clear that they will disappear because we project surpluses in China to remain elevated, and we also project commodity prices to be under tensions for surprises on the upside and therefore for more savings in this part of the world, especially the Middle East. So with that, I think I will just bear with me for a second because this chart is not, this is the drawback of animation. You have to go, okay. So with that, I just want to conclude on one point. I've convinced you that capital flows are very volatile, so government should care about it. And on this front, our views have recently at the IMF have evolved. We used to be fairly averse to capital controls, as you know. I mean, we used to be, as I said, before the Asia crisis, strong proponents of capital account opening. We have then become much more critical relative to capital account opening. And now we've taken a step further, and we're even going into the opposite direction by endorsing capital flow. We call it, excuse me, to be politically correct, we call it capital flow measures. You know, so measures that are, you know, we don't call it capital control. You can see, it's not easy. It's a change that is not easy for us. You know?
The threatening thing if you come with a malicious thing of capital control.
So the bottom line is, when do we advocate capital flow controls? Well, let's say we have a big capital inflow surge. You see that on the top there in this. It can have two reasons: macroeconomic reasons or financial stability. It can raise macroeconomic concerns, or it can raise financial stability concerns. Let's leave the financial stability concerns aside for the moment. Let's just look at the macroeconomic concerns which are on the left. Well, if it raises macroeconomic concerns, the first line of defense in our view is macroeconomic policy. So you look at your exchange rate, let it appreciate. But if it's overappreciated, of course, then that is not a good idea. Then we say accumulate reserves if it's overappreciated. But, you know, you may already have some in reserves, and it doesn't make that much sense anymore. And we say, like, well, maybe you can change the fiscal and monetary policy mix, but that too may not be enough. If all of that is not enough, if all of these options are exhausted, then we say that you can impose or intensify. Here it uses the politically incorrect words of capital controls, but what we mean is capital flow measures, actually. So this is where we stand. So the bottom line view here is one where we think capital flow measures are now part of the toolkit of policymakers to combat volatility caused by capital flows. And with this, I want to conclude and open the floor for questions. Thank you.